So we're going to open up now for discussion of the previous speakers. So I asked the panel to start the discussion going. Alice, you already had your hand up. Introduce yourself, please. You didn't do that.
Hi, Alice Massetti from NHLBI USA. My question, I think, is for Dr. Keevil. It sounded like you were going in your talk down the road of suggesting that the procedural aspects or the anatomic presence of the device shouldn't be counted against the efficacy of the therapy under consideration. I guess it's the effectiveness versus efficacy issue. I guess I'd say if that were the case, then we wouldn't have the whole cabbage versus PCI argument because the surgeons would say, you know, well, let's just discount the fact that it's kind of morbid to open up the chest, but gee, we really do better revascularization, which they do. I'm not sure how you can peel off, pare away issues of procedural effects or anatomic effects of having an implanted device, or maybe that isn't what you were suggesting.
I guess I did a poor job in my presentation. If I was unclear about that, I think just the opposite. I think the effects of the procedure are integral to the therapy, the intervention package, I think, as Professor Pocock mentioned. And in order to get a real complete evaluation of overall safety and overall effectiveness, we need to look at the combined effects of procedure, placement, and active therapy with regard to safety and also with regard to effectiveness.
Roxanne?
This is really to... it's Roxana Moran, cardiologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. This is for Bill, Dr. Abraham. I think that this whole notion of optimal medical therapy is a fabulous thing if it's actually possible. And even in the best controlled trials, as you showed us, compliance and adherence to those guideline therapies are at about 20-25% in certain medications. We know this from CABG versus PCI, where the background therapy is supposed to be optimal medical therapy and the patients are hardly ever reaching goals, 15-20%, even in FAME too, with the best and courage and freedom. So this whole notion of optimal medical therapy, I have a little bit of an issue with, and I think that what we're doing is creating a scenario in randomized clinical trials that are not replicated in the real world. How do we, as a panel, I mean, all of us, we really need to think about that because we, you know, we put the trialists and the investigators through hell to actually make sure they're meeting the top optimal medical therapy. The trial takes much longer than it needs to, and at the end of the day, we can't replicate that type of background therapy to the real world.
No, I think you make a very good point, and it does, you know, speak to a couple of issues in regard to, patient selection. You know, how representative are these patients of the real world, and how can we generalize these data subsequently? So it does pose some difficulties. It really involves the balance between trying to demonstrate incremental benefit of a new therapy or new device on top of what exists by making sure that what exists is actually used adequately, versus, I think, some real-world representation of these patients and, making clinical trials more feasible. We are having in heart failure... We are having substantial difficulties enrolling patients in clinical trials because I think we have made it so difficult through this and through other requirements. So, a decade ago, it wasn't very difficult to enroll patients in a heart failure trial. Today, I don't know of a heart failure trial that is not way behind on its projected pace of enrollment, and we have created... we've raised the bar so high that I think we have created the type of barriers that you mentioned. So it's a balance. I don't know where the right answer is.
Well, I'm going to take a little bit of a different view on this one. We've done the trials. Let's use the drugs, and let's use them appropriately. Why are you going to subject someone to another therapy when they haven't received the things that have been proven? And we know from the quality literature that very often physician sort of inertia does not allow the increase of drugs. And we have seen this now in the small PROTECT trial, and we're about to go into the guided trial, where we're actually going to say you need to optimize medical therapy in both groups. Now, the HF action trial of the NIH, our mean carvedilol dose was 37, but we had a committee that really kept after people to do the right thing. So I don't think that we can just say, well, it's difficult to do, let's not do it. It can be done.
So I totally agree, and I'm in total agreement. I'm not saying that we should give up on optimal medical therapy. I think we need to go back and say, how do we optimize this whole optimal medical therapy issue? And is it just these committees, or are there other things to do? Before we come to these, device trials.
I mean, that's the existence of heart failure programs, where we are able to see the patients regularly and do the whole disease management protocol. That includes diet and education, and yes, you have to keep after them, and yes, there are some people that will never comply. But it is doable, and the VA system can show you the numbers and the doses, which are very doable. Rita, I think you had a comment.
Just to add really what you were, Rita Redberg, I'm a cardiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, that I think the optimal medical therapy that you were showing in your slides is taken from the original drug studies when those drugs were shown to be effective. And so I do think it's important, and certainly not to make the trial harder, but that we really could do a lot better at medical therapy and getting patients to optimal doses. And I think for whatever reason, we've really backed off on it. I mean, I know when I attend in the cardiology wards, the house staffs will start our patients at 3.2, I mean, these tiny little doses of carvedilol, and they get to be afraid of increasing them. And I don't know why. We study them at high doses, and then we start at these tiny doses. And unfortunately, you can't say then that they're on medical therapy. And then, to try to talk about devices, and we know, unfortunately, for the PCI versus medical therapy, a lot of people getting PCI are not on optimal medical therapy. There are a fair number that are on no medical therapy before they get PCI. So I really think that you made an excellent point that we really need to be not just on medical therapy, but on optimal medical therapy before we want to do an addition of an interventional device.
Yeah, Ken Stein, Boston Scientific. I mean, those points are well taken. The one thing that concerns me, and these are obviously going to be different for different types of devices, is obviously there are some devices that may permit patients who couldn't previously be up titrated or even started on medications to be placed on those medications. By not allowing those patients in a trial to begin with, you completely lose that potential beneficial effect in that population.
I see your point. You're, for instance, saying that if patient does not tolerate beta blockers, it may tolerate it after CRT. And I think the issue is avoiding those type of patients. The issue is having a guarantee that this patient has appropriately tried whether he's tolerant to the drug, and so what kind of control is given on that issue, I believe. And once you show that the patient cannot tolerate the dose which is approved or considered to be the best dose, I think that's a good patient for a trial. Actually, it's an excellent patient for the trial, provided you have proven that.
Any more comments?
Yeah, I think it's very important that you really make a good...
You want to introduce yourself,
yes,
please.
Cecilia Linde, Stockholm, Sweden. That you really make a job of up-titrating the drugs before entering the trial. And what we don't want is that physicians then, after entering into device trial, up-titrate drugs, because then you cannot really know to what extent the benefit that you might find is attributed to the CRT or to up-titration of beta blockers. And so I think it's extremely important, and it is a bit of a delusion, because at sometimes you find somebody is no longer eligible for the trials when beta blockers, for example, have been up-titrated. They got so well that they are not eligible anymore, and that's frustrating, but that's part of our job.
I think Mark had, and then Bill. Mark?
Carlson, St. Jude Medical. My question for Professor Pocock. I really enjoyed your talk, and I admire your composure when faced with technical adversity. The implication of the title of your talk is that we should trust randomized controlled trials, I believe. At least that's what one might infer. And I was really intrigued by your propensity analysis for observational studies. But we know that in randomized controlled trials, there can be biases as well, and certainly populations that are underrepresented based on age or gender or concomitant diseases, whatever. Has anybody ever applied the similar type of analysis to weight according to gender differently or according to age differently as compared to not between the two groups within the trial but compared to the real world distribution of gender that might receive a therapy in a randomized controlled trial?
Yes, so you mean to I distinguish between a trial not necessarily being representative of the target population.
Exactly.
Which is a different concept from
right.
a bias of getting a wrong
it's
comparison.
It's a bias between
from
the trial
a
and the real world versus two treatment groups.
I think we struggle with that because, firstly, I don't think the method of analysis would be the same if you're trying to sort of correct for the non-representative of a trial, if I understand the point. So I'm not sure how you could do that because you're stuck with the trial population. If you feel, I suppose in principle, if you feel females are underrepresented, then you could do a sort of weighted analysis, upping the weight in females. But as far as I know, nobody ever does it. They take the trial result as known. The other thing is if there are subgroups that are unrepresented, then you'd like to get into subgroup analysis, but you never have enough power within a trial to go in subgroups. So I think the non-representativeness of a trial is maybe staring you in the face, but I don't know whether other statisticians would like to join in, Nancy for instance, but I don't know of any tricks up our sleeves that could make the trial more representative. And it's not a propensity analysis, I don't think that's applicable.
You could monitor accrual as the trial is ongoing. If you found you had an underrepresentation, say, of women, then you could either stop enrollment of men or encourage, point out to the investigators that you've got this underrepresentation. But I think a weighted analysis, I agree with Stuart, I don't think it would be very credible. If you said, oh, dear, we're underrepresented for minority groups, we're going to upweight the minority groups. I really don't think that would be very acceptable.
To think more positively to the future, you'd want to make your trials more pragmatic so that they get nearer to the world, real world.
So there's why would it be credible in the one case but not in the other?
Sorry, I don't understand.
Why is it credible to do that sort of a weighting in an observational trial but not
because
that sort of weighting in the other case?
Because in a randomized trial, at least you get two groups who will be balanced as regards baseline factors. That's what randomization does. Whereas in the observational registry, you're trying to compare two treatment groups, of which the ASSERT registry was a good example, which are vastly different in their baseline characteristics. It's the underlying difference between how you analyze any observational study, whether it's about treatment or not. That's why epidemiologists inevitably use totally different statistical methods to what trialists do. It's the correction of observational selection.
I think we have two more questions, one from Professor Slide from the audience and then one from the web.
Good. Pushing.
Don't give him the microphone.
He was.
would you
now I can really do it.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Peter Slide, Oxford. Sorry. you were pushing the randomized trials, and everybody has done that, and I'm a great believer in it. But I always remember Richard Peto saying about randomized trials, particularly about subgroup analysis, and that was, fun to look at, but don't believe it. And I think the point is that you were mentioning subgroup analysis of trials, and that's a hypothesis-generating thing. You have to do another trial afterwards because you'll always find subgroups. And this is really, really common. People do a trial and then they pick out subgroups and they believe it. And it's a shame.
Oh, just to say, there's actually, I'm sorry to disappoint you, there's no disagreement between us. I absolutely agree.
I'm sure there isn't. You didn't mention it.
So yeah, I'm sorry.
I have a question from the web.
I'm one of the cardiology fellows from Duke. I'm serving as a conduit for questions from the internet. So if you have a question from Brazil, they want to know what you feel about the probe study design in randomized controlled trials.
You go first, Nancy? No, okay.
Nancy, you get to introduce yourself this time.
Sorry, I'm Nancy Geller from NHLBI. Actually, this is an advertisement at the workshop, which is in a couple of days. Some of you will be staying. I'll be talking about blinding, and I will talk explicitly about the probe design. So that's unblinded design, which basically has to be used in certain kinds of trials. Some kind of comparative effectiveness trial, and my example is ACCORD, where different diabetes drugs were allowed and you were aiming for different levels of HbA1c. But to blind that would be pretty prohibitive. So what I think about it is that sometimes it's the only practical thing to do. Would I do it when I could blind more easily? No.
Just to say, I think one thing that helps the probe design to be more okay is if the endpoints are completely hard. So if you have a study in which all-cause mortality is your outcome, you're on a lot stronger footing with a probe design than if you've got some outcomes that contain an element of subjectivity or observer variation. So I think that makes a difference. A probe, what does probe stand for those who don't know? It's a prospective observer blinded endpoint. Yeah, okay, thank you. But that, nobody heard that, by the way.
Prospective randomized open blinded endpoint.
We're going to have to move on. I had one final question for Holger about measuring the living better part. I agree with you that it would be really terrific to be able to capture that. How do you do that in an unblinded trial?
Well, it's as you put it, it's really, really difficult. I mean, the point is, I think we have to use different measures and then look for the trajectories of improvement. So, which would be could be an exercise test and a disease-specific and non-specific quality of life questionnaire. And I think at least we have some good tools with the KCCQ, for example, for heart failure. We have some disease unspecific ones, and we have some good exercise tests. And if you get in all those three domains, for example, improvements, I think then we can talk about a more robust effect for the patient.